population. Tsarist censorship. Census of 1913, only 43% of the population were Great Russians. Determined linguistically, right? Most of them are literate. That means 57% were not. Now, let us look at this realistically. There's a very, very big difference between the Poles, the Finns, the Latvians, and so on, Lithuanians, who were typically, in terms of social structure and outlook, more advanced than the mass of backward Great Russians, and Central Asian, Siberian Aboriginals, and so on and so forth, who were even more backward, were still further in the Middle Ages. More backward doesn't mean they were fine. In 1916, in fact, there was a serious rising in what is now Soviet Central Asia, of Muslim tribesmen and so on and so forth. The point is that the regime was a regime of ultra, becoming more so as time went on, Russian great nationalism. I won't talk about it except to say this. Do you remember, those of you who have read biographies of Rosa Luxemburg, it was forbidden for Polish children to speak Polish in school. They had to speak Russian, which they didn't know, and so on and so forth. You know? The whole element of national oppression added a further destabilizing element. How did the thing last so long? It lasted so long because it depended on a mass conscript peasant army, a military police machine, a bureaucracy, and until the crisis of the First World War, basically, if not the support, the tolerance of the landowning ruling classes and even most of the big capitalists. And then this regime, you know, whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad, actually, not only entered, but was one of the precipitating factors in creating the First World War. Finding themselves against an opponent, I mean their major opponent, Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, all right, similarly shaky, but come on against Germany, which was at a qualitatively higher level in terms of technique, in terms of production, in terms, let us be blunt about it, of a layer of educated or half-educated, we will call them non-commissioned officers, precisely what was missing in the Russian days, and with an officer corps who we think are rather stupid and so on. Yes, they were rather stupid. My God, Russian standards, they were rather brilliant. I mean, this, you know, you have to understand the gap here. Okay, so we'll talk about the war very briefly. 1914, the myth was destroyed. Biggest army in the world, big offensive, Russian steamroller and so on, was shattered actually in Poland by numerically significantly inferior German forces. They lost Poland, which had been, you know, central Poland, which is part of their territory. Okay? That's not so significant in itself, except in terms of their morale. Subsequently, a whole series of ups and downs. Basically, they appear significantly inferior, systematically inferior to their opponents. Which brings me to 1916. And 1916 is a fundamentally important date, not only in terms of Russian history, but German, British, and so on. 1916, Redl, the Somme, those who remember, dominated the capital, twisted the arms of the Tsarist regime to make a major offensive. They were totally incapable, in reality, of doing so. You read the accounts, splendid accounts, some of them quoted in Facebook or in Trotsky and various other sources. Here we have these huge masses. They had manpower, they had any amount of manpower. They had soldiers without boots. These are the descriptions, not by the way of left-wing critics, but of the officers. Soldiers without boots, soldiers without ammunition, even soldiers without rifles. Nevertheless, after all, major imperialist power, aim for Constantinople, the Straits, the domination of the Balkans, absorb Romania, and so on and so forth, the regime launched its last great offensive. It was supposed to be one up and down the front. In fact, only one serious operation took place, the Brusilov offensive in Galicia. And all that I need to say about that is that after initial success, which was disastrous for them, because it led them on, they were slaughtered. You know, we know about the casualties on the Somme. We know that the British army, in the course of 9 weeks, lost about 400,000 men. That's a lot more than their present strength, by the way, and that's in 9 weeks. The Russian casualties were certainly greater, much, much greater. But such is a low level of reportage and the general incompetence, we don't know what they were. One thing is certain, 1916, by the autumn of 1916, the Russian army was finished as a serious offensive operation. Why am I talking about this? Oh, come on, come on. Tell you, great events, independent of the will of parties and individuals. That was a great event because it transformed the attitudes of millions of the peasant soldiers. I don't mean it made them Bolsheviks, far from it. It made them unwilling to go for another offensive. Now we look at the crisis at the top. You know, Chris's famous thing about the fish rotting from the head. I am not certain that it's always true, but it was most certainly true in the case of the Tsarist regime. I said, the autocracy had, politically speaking, as opposed to bureaucratically, a fantastically narrow base. After the defeat of the offensive, Christ, they lost a lot of territory, they lost hundreds of thousands of troops and so on. There was a general movement to get rid of elements of the regime, not amongst the masses, amongst the leading classes. A word or two about this regime. They were lumbered. That's one of the problems with the hereditary monarchy, isn't it? You have an idiot in charge. It is not so easy to say, out with the idiot. His wife, a much stronger person who dominated him, was herself under the influence of a truly medieval figure. The monk Rasputin, who believed that, holy water and crossing yourself 10 times before you went into battle were the essential preoccupations. Above all, that clique brought into power, into executive office, a bunch of people who were being ignorant, corrupt, and in many cases highly corrupt, and above all, totally incompetent. Is this the revolutionary view? Not at all. I can't resist a couple of quotations on this. I can find anything there. Well, yes, I can. We are speaking of late 1916. Here is the French ambassador. I mean, they say there are various quotations. I haven't spoken about the Duma. There was this nominal parliament. I must speak about it. You know, Babel, a German social democratic leader, described the Reichstag in the Kaiser's time as a fig leaf for absolutism. A fig leaf. The Duma was not even a fig leaf. Or if it was, it was made of transparent material. It had no powers of any kind. Nevertheless, it existed after 1905 as a nominal consultative body. And we find leaders, people from the centre of the ruling class going talking to Duma, represented. Here is the president of the Duma at lunch with the Grand Duchess Maria Pavlovna. I'm sorry, my listener is not real. She spoke of the situation in the interior and the utter worthlessness of the government and the empress. It is necessary to remove, to destroy. I tried to find out what she was driving about, what she meant to remove. And she said, it is necessary to undertake something. You must understand. The Duma must do something. She should be done away with. Killed, in other words. Not Margaret Thatcher. The Queen. This is from the upper circles. I don't believe for a whole host of them. Let us look at 28th of December 1916. The French ambassador attended what was politely called a supper. I quote, "Yesterday evening, Prince Gabriel Konstantinovich gave a supper for his mistress, formerly Electress. The guests included the Grand Dukes Nikolai and Boris, a number of officers, and a squad of elegant courtesans. During the evening, the only topic was the conspiracy." Change the regime. All this? They thought, which regiments of the Guard can be relied on? The most favourable moment for the outbreak and so on. And all this, the servants moving about, the harlots looking on and listening, gypsies singing, and the whole company bathed in the aroma of champagne which flowed in torrents. Now, this is the top. This is the top of the regime, and it is of some significance. Because we now come to the crisis. The crisis of February 1917. By the way, I am using consistently in this the old dates, because I can't do the arithmetic. You know, they're, what is it, 7, 8 days. And anyway, they've passed into history, haven't they? All right, you said it's something different. The question then of the 5 days. The regime was rotten at the top. It was so rotten that it was not possible for its leading figures to arrange a coup to simply remove the most rotten, corrupt, incompetent elements. They talked about a coup. I quoted one thing, I could quote many others. They didn't get round to it in time. And then came a significant event. A very significant event indeed, which we would not have thought in advance, I don't think we would have thought in advance, was to be of immense importance. And I cannot do better, comrades, than to quote Trotsky's own account of this. I apologise for reading quotations, but he's so brilliant that I cannot equal it, never mind. The 23rd of February, old date, was International Women's Day. By the way, if there are any militant feminists here, let us be quite clear, International Women's Day was established by Marxist social democrats, not by the bourgeois feminist movement. However, it's a fact, it's a fact. The 23rd of February was International Women's Day. The social democratic circles had intended to mark this day in a general manner, by meetings, speeches, leaflets about women's rights, the situation of women in society, and so on and so forth. Excellent. Not a single organisation, I should quote the previous tense, it had not occurred to anyone that it might become the first day of the revolution. Not a single organisation called for strikes that day. What is more, even the Bolshevik organisations, including their most militant ones, this is in Petrograd, the Vyborg Borough Committee, the Vanguard, you know, the major engineering centre where the Putilov works was situated and so on, these organisations were opposing strikes at this time. Now, don't laugh, let's see why. The temper of the masses, according to Kasparov, one of the leaders of the Vyborg district, was very tense. Any strike would turn into an open fight. But since the committee thought that the time unripe for militant action, the party was not strong enough. There were not enough connections with the soldiers. They had decided not to call strikes, but to prepare for revolutionary action at some indefinite time in the future. Now, if you think that they were a bunch of waverers and useless people, this is very, very far from the case. You see, hindsight is a beautiful thing, and I only wish I could have it formed, so to say. They made calculations. They were serious revolutionaries, serious working class men.
They knew the regime had 90,000 infantry in and around Petrograd, plus 10 to 12,000 gendarmerie, plus an undetermined number of Cossacks, which was probably at least 20,000 or so. And what's more, the railway system in Russia was lousy, yes, but it withers at the extremes. The trains to Petrograd were still running. They could massively reinforce this, massively reinforce it very quickly. You read Sliapnikov's memoirs, you know, this calculation, absolutely clear. I've had to say, absolutely reasonable in the circumstances. I'm absolutely certain I would have gone along with it, you know, writer's tendencies and all that. It turned out to be catastrophically wrong. How? Let us continue. Let us continue. However, on the following morning, they decided, you know, 23rd, we do nothing. On the 21st, 22nd. Except we have a few meetings. We give out a few leaflets, you know, and all the rest of it. And we talk about women's rights. However, on the following morning, in spite of all directives, because the party, which is the only really organised force in Petrograd, in the working class, has sent out directives, don't stick your necks out, you'll get your heads chopped off. Demonstrate, yes. Leaflet, yes. Women's rights, yes. And if you can push it further, denounce the Tsar and so on, but don't come out. However, in spite of all directives, the women textile workers in several factories went on strike. The party influence amongst them was weak. You know why it was weak? Because previously they had been backward. That's the reality. Unlike, you know, the metal trades where the party strength was. And so, they didn't pay any heed to the party directives, if indeed they ever heard of them. They went on strike. And then, Enterprise Initiative sent delegates to the metal workers with an appeal for support. With reluctance, writes Kayanov, he was the secretary of the Vyborg district, the Bolsheviks agreed to this. And we were followed by the workers. Because once there is a mass strike, one must call everyone into the streets and take the lead. A very healthy reaction. But still, they had no faith in the outcome. Yes, I know. So I must be... Actually, it is worth looking at the result. 23rd was the first of the 5 days. The 5 days of the February Revolution. There was a fairly widespread strike because, you know, the local Bolshevik leadership turned around at the last minute and was able to lead people out. It wasn't sensational. Moreover, what was its political content? Apart from the general question of women's rights, it was increase the bread ration. All the accounts agree. So on the first day, on the 23rd, there was no question, at least in any mass sense, of down with the Tsar, down with the government, down with the war, anything like that. What is more, and here we look back to the other side, the reaction of the regime was very, very cautious. Why? Look back to their own crisis. Look back to the rotting of self-confidence. Look back to, also, the calculation of experienced police generals, you know, Khabarov, commanding the gendarmerie forces in Petrograd. It's a demonstration. Let them demonstrate, they'll go back tomorrow. Shooting would be, I quote him, shooting would be a mistake. But the mistake was obvious. The next day, taking Petrograd. True. The Bolshevik leadership by this time, the local Bolshevik leadership, Lenin knew nothing about it, of course, he was in Switzerland. The local Bolshevik leadership exerted themselves to bring out everyone possible because they sensed, and this is the great virtue of the revolutionary training, that really this is sensational. Never before have we had such an operation on Women's Day. Therefore, push it. But even so, as Sliapnikov says, he thought, you can always
ritual. The treat wasn't necessary. The next day, massive demonstrations, clashes with the police, two shootings. And then we come to the crisis, which is the 25th. By this time, the local Bolshevik leadership was thoroughly committed.
They had, if you like, and it's an experience which I hope all comrades are going to have, under certain circumstances you find that your supporters, who you thought were more backward than you and have to be coaxed along, actually are ahead of you, and you think, my God, come on. Several jumps. On that day, matters were much more serious. The police fired. We shouldn't think the February Revolution was bloodless. More than 1,700 people were shot in Petrograd. Great majority of them workers, the minority, almost all police, hardly any soldiers on either side. But then, you see, they saw the crack. And, of course, brought out the troops, the Cossacks, first of all. And there's a lovely description in Trotsky's, quoting various accounts. Yes, the Cossacks, given the orders, charged. But actually, when the crowd moved aside for them to go through, they went through. And some of them winked. Discipline is disintegrated. Let us go back to Engels. No real revolution without the disintegration of the army. Now this is, of all sections of the army, the most significant. Not in a military sense. In a military sense, of course, the infantry masses, for Christ's sake, nearly 90,000, would slaughter any revolution. But these are professional, better paid, better treated troops. I haven't time to go into the history of the Cossack thing, but they are better paid, better treated, the most reliable crops of the regime. And then, towards the end of the same day, we have a bitter break. 21 soldiers of the Pazlovsky regiment. I don't know what Pazlovsky is. 21 soldiers. Not only deserted, which we would have said was a mistake, they an agitate amongst your fellows, never mind. Not only deserted, they took their rifles with them. And not only did they take their rifles with them and ball ammunition, they shot 3 mounted gendarmes, not Cossacks, the police thing. And from then on, you know, the thing is on the knife edge. If the soldiers of the garrison will actually obey orders, we're finished. No question, don't let's deceive ourselves. We're finished. The Tsarist regime had enough, and many more than enough troops to crush any insurrection. But the next day showed the other regiments did not mutiny. Most of them, few did. Most of them did not mutiny. They simply declined to shoot when given the orders. And then, once this had taken place, and it's a matter of hours, the regime was doomed. Let me remind you of what I said early on. Very early on, you know, about the psychology of the Nazis. If I can find it. I can't find it. Perhaps I didn't.